Blog Talk Radio.
Beautiful, 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 beautiful. I just wanted to start the show today with just a little bit of the music from one group by the name of Earth, Wind, and Fire. Their leader, Maurice White, passed away yesterday at the age of 74. He'd been sick for a while, had Parkinson's disease, and I think he'd been sick for almost about 8 or 9 years. But if you want to talk about a group that I, as one person, I know I speak for a lot of other people, wore the grooves off of the albums. That's the way of the world. All in all, I am Spirit, the best of Earth, Wind, and Fire. Faces, what's the other one I had? Oh, Now, Then, and Forever. The first three or four albums especially were just unbelievable. And he was the ringleader. He not only sang, but he did a lot of the writing of the songs, and just a great man. Help Somebody, Love Is Life, September, Come On Children. Oh my goodness, just so much music. And like I said, he passed away yesterday at the age of 74. So we just wanted to start with a little bit of his music. Great band. Their music will last forever, forever. So, my name is Louis Kincaid. The show is called The Runaround. It is Friday, February 5th. And I mentioned earlier in the week, I had just started the show up again. I had been doing it for a few years, and life got in the way and working and all that stuff, and I'm just starting it again. I think as long as I'm doing it on a weekly basis, I'm going to try to make Friday kind of a catch-all day, and for lack of a better word, I'm going to call it, or a phrase, I'm going to call it Free Flow Friday. So I'm just going to grab a bunch of things that are in the news. Obviously, we're going to talk about the politics and the debate last night with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. But I'm also going to talk about a 17-year-old who was an actress, who confidently showed her scars from a breast reduction she had. She's 17 years old. Okay. I don't know, as a guy, maybe I shouldn't be speaking on it, but I did, and I got my comeuppance from some of the women folks. So we'll discuss that. Obviously, this Sunday is that game. Did you know, I don't know if everyone knows this, but did you know that when commercials are run, let's say this past week or 2 weeks ago, that unless you are NFL sanctioned, you cannot use the phrase Super Bowl? The only people that can say Super Bowl are NFL networks, or, you know, CBS is running it, so they can do commercials that say Super Bowl. But otherwise, you can't run around and say a commercial, hey, at our grocery store this week, we're having 2 for $5, 12 packs for the big Super Bowl. Okay. You will get sued by the NFL. Crazy. NFL runs everything. So I'm going to give you my prediction. I have not given it out this week. Well, I have, but no one knows it on this show yet. So I'm going to talk about it. The great Peyton Manning against Cam Newton. And for the last time, and I doubt that will be the last time, but I like to say that for effect, I'm going to explain what Cam Newton meant a week ago when he was talking about being unapologetically black. I'm going to try to break it down a la Chris Rock, maybe. I'm going to try to give it to you straight, no chaser, and hopefully everyone will get it. It won't take me too long. But I'm going to start today, and then there's some other things that, just like I said, I'm just going to do some grab bag. Maybe talk about a few of the movies that are up for our best movie of the year. Oscars are coming up in a few weeks. We'll see how the time flows today. But I will start with that debate last night between Hillary Rodham Clinton. She got a lot of grief, I think, when she was younger for using her middle name because women weren't used to using their maiden names as part of their name professionally. She should have just been Hillary Clinton. So when Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas, she was Hillary Rodham. And people in Arkansas kind of took a little offense to that. So I think that's when she became Hillary Rodham Clinton. I think for a while she became Hillary Clinton. She took the Rodham off. And now, again, she's Hillary Rodham Clinton. But, you know, back in the 70s, you know, down in the South, people weren't used to a woman holding on to her maiden name. So they weren't up for that. But she figured that out and made the change. The debate last night between Hillary Clinton and Secretary Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders was probably for, you know, and I'm trying not to be partisan. I'm really just trying to look at this as what debate had the most substance involved. I would have to say last night between two people, you know, right now the Republican field has been as many as 15, 16 people, and they've had to have the kiddie table debate with four or five people and then the 12 or 13 other people in the regular debate. Which, you know, a real political debate, you really need no more than four or five people. I mean, that's how you can kind of get an exchange of ideas and give people time to unwind what they're trying to say. And obviously, when we come down to the president of the United States, when it comes to this fall, it's going to be mano a mano or mano a womano. So, you know, two is just really the right, maybe three, but two is really the right one because you're going to go head to head. So the moderators last night, who were Chuck Todd, the person who runs Meet the Press, and Rachel Maddow from MSNBC, I thought did a pretty good job. You know, it was a two-hour debate. You can't cover every subject. They missed a few subjects, but, you know, they really didn't talk about jobs. They didn't talk about criminal justice, Black Lives Matter. That wasn't in the discussion, but they did go over domestic policy. They most certainly did. And in domestic policy, I would have to say right now, Bernie Sanders is just, he's in the lead. He is in control of the debate when it is on anything to do with Wall Street, anything to do with the economy, because this man, like I've said all week, has been talking about the same thing for 40 years. You listen to Bernie Sanders from 1975, he's talking about the top 1% that's crushing the 99%, how banks have the game rigged. And I'll tell you what, last night he went a step farther that I think is a little much. He said that Wall Street, the business of Wall Street, is fraud, F-R-A-U-D, fraud. Now, are individuals obviously committing fraud in Wall Street? Sure. Corporations, Goldman Sachs? Sure. You know, the whole thing with the economy crashing in 2008, that was about bunching a bunch of bad mortgages together and making them securities that people could bet on, essentially. And they were bad bets, but you could also bet that they would go down as much as you could bet that they would go up. And the people who bet down on them, those are the few that made the money. The people that thought the mortgages were secure financial instruments and thought that they would be okay, that's the majority of people who lost money. But Bernie Sanders went there last night. He went there. And now this is what he's going to have to run on. If he were to win the Democratic nomination, he is going to have to run on him saying that the business of Wall Street is fraud. I think that's a little strong. I know he has ways to prove it, but I can't say that every single person that works downtown New York on Wall Street are doing fraudulent deals. And I think one of the problems with Bernie Sanders is while he can say right now, I'm beating Trump in the polls, and you know, he always says, well, polls go up, polls go down, but I'm beating Trump in the polls by 14 points. Ms. Clinton's only beating him by 1 point. I think if he were to win the Democratic nomination for president, he will get pilloried for that statement. And just what he wants to do overall with the domestic economy. He wants to change everything. He wants to break up the banks. more mom and pop banks around the country, no more Citicorp, Goldman Sachs, all the big banks. There's six of them. He wants to break them. He wants to break them up and devolve it down to mom and pop shops or in our neighborhoods. He wants to do some radical things. And there is a group, there are many people who, at least 3 to 4 million around the country, who are contributing an average of $27 a piece to Senator Sanders' campaign. So he has a lot of people who are believing in him. A lot of the youth vote is behind him. His black vote is not large, but it is growing. And the New Hampshire primary is Tuesday. He has been up in the polls by as much as 30 points. It has closed the last 3 or 4 days. But he is giving Secretary Clinton all she can handle. So when they discussed last night the domestic Wall Street issues, he was definitely in the lead on that. There is no doubt that he made points that she couldn't come back on other than say, me too. That's a lot of what Secretary Clinton said. And then her weak point is when he started talking about her speaking fees. And when she spoke to people such as Goldman Sachs, after she left the Secretary of State position in 2013, the last 2 or 3 years, she's been doing speaking engagements. And she's been paid up to $200,000, $225,000 per. I think she did 3 speeches for Goldman Sachs, and it came out to $675,000. Now, Secretary Clinton has had a problem in explaining this. She has a hard time explaining why they're paying her so much money and what is she going to do for them if she were to become president. She's having problems getting through this. Ms. Clinton, take my advice. The reason they paid you, the money that they paid you, was because they believed that someday you would be president of the United States. They are paying you for the fact that you may have something valuable to say about what you believe, not that you're going to do something necessarily absolutely for them or change your position from what it was before to now what it is because you paid me $225,000. I think that would work, but she's been trying to work her way through answering the question, and it hasn't gotten there yet. She's just not. You know, I think, 2 years ago, she said, Bill and I were broke. So we had to start working, after they came out of the White House. So this would have been in 2000. We were broke. So I had to start making speeches or Bill did, actually, because at that time in 2000, as President Clinton was leaving office, Senator Clinton was the senator from New York. So he was making the speeches at that time. Then after 2013, Secretary Clinton has made the speeches. Don't listen. You have a right to earn money. The issue is, and the thing that Bernie Sanders is hammering her on, is that if you're getting this money from these companies, you must be doing something for them. He's always creating this dark cloud over her that if she's getting paid this much money, you must be doing something for them that's not right. Now, Bernie Sanders can say that writ large. He can say that the deck is stacked. These people aren't for us. It's the 1% against the 99%. There's nothing specifically that he can pin on Secretary Clinton that she has taken this money, earned it. I'm a capitalist. She earned it. They said they wanted her to speak. She said yes. Obviously, you find out how much, her agent, they paid her. I think that's how it works in this country. Now, from that point on, do you then say she did something wrong? Because Senator Sanders has nothing he can say that she did wrong for earning this money. She gave a speech. She earned the money. You're worth what they pay you. That's what I've always been told. We complain about the money that athletes make, the money that movie stars make when they make a movie. you earn your worth what they pay you. I don't know how else we're going to do it in the society unless Senator Sanders wants to start making a law that says you can only make so much when you speak. And if you are going to run for office, you have to give back. He hasn't, and he's not clear on what she has done. So he keeps making insinuations that it's bad for her to take this money, but specifically he has nothing on her. So last night, the first hour or so was domestic, the domestic economy, Wall Street issues, and it looked like Secretary Clinton was fighting her way through it. She made it through. Again, she was saying, me too," but it was pretty much on Senator Sanders' terrain, he did a pretty good job. What is scary about Senator Sanders is what happened at the beginning of the second hour of the debate when it went to foreign policy. And I will tell you personally, I am scared for this man. He has very little foreign policy experience. He proves it by not saying much other than me too and President Clinton and President Obama. Yes, I agree with what he did. And the only thing that he has against Secretary Clinton is that she made the vote in 2002 for the war in Iraq. Okay, my take. I get it in 2007, 2008, when then Senator Obama made the charge against Ms. Clinton. You voted for the war in Iraq. I was never for it. Here's where we are. You made the wrong decision. We need hope and change. Version of Senator Obama then, 2007. And that was a big issue, that she voted for the war. He didn't. And at that time, we're in the middle of the war. It had already turned bad, 2007. It started turning bad, 2004, 2005. Abu Ghraib, the whole prison thing, when the prisoners were being abused and they were crawling around like dogs and had leashes on them, that whole mess. Just a lot of stuff was going on. And, you know, then American soldiers were getting, or not even soldiers, sometimes it was contractors working in Iraq, getting hung up by their neck, like literally lynched and burned, a lynching. So the war had become a mess by 2007, 2008. And that was an effective gambit for then Senator Obama to run against Ms. Clinton. We're in 2016 now. And yes, she made a bad vote to approve the war in Iraq while President Bush was president. But that's 15 years ago. And right now, that can't be your foreign policy strategy, Senator Sanders. You're going to have to move on from that. That can't be the only thing that you can talk about versus Secretary Clinton. So when it got to the foreign policy, defense, how are we going to take care of our country? How are we going to protect our country, which I'm very strong on? I may be a Democrat, but I believe in foreign policy and I believe in a strong defense. Senator Sanders has not much going for him. He's very weak there. And I tell you, again, if he were to become the nominee between saying that the business of Wall Street is a fraud and not having much gravitas, much substance when it comes to foreign policy. I don't care what kind of lead he has on Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, Republican front runners. I can't see how he's going to win. Beyond that, then we have this whole issue that I've talked about before. He's got to win over people in Congress for all these policy changes he wants to make to the economy. If he wants to totally rein in Wall Street or destroy Wall Street, if he wants to break up the top six banks, he can't just sign a piece of paper. He's going to have people in Congress that are going to start the bill. It's like the Constitution. We got to do the constitutional thing. Congress, House of Representatives start bills. So who in Congress is going to go along with the policies that Senator Sanders wants? Can't answer that yet. So I think in the long run right now, Senator Clinton is She's in a battle. She's in a battle, and that's good. Now it's been said before that if she didn't have anyone to run against, she wasn't going to be prepared for the fall. Now that she has someone to run against and it is giving her a good race, now she's going to be weakened. So, you know, from the Republican side, she was wrong on both counts. If she didn't have anybody to run against her, she was going to be unprepared for the battle in the fall. Now she's got somebody running against her, now she's going to be weakened. Enough. It's just going to be a very tough race for her. New Hampshire is Tuesday. Senator Sanders has had up to a 30-point lead. It's closed down to 20 points. The game will be if she can get under 10 points. It would be remarkable, unbelievable upset if she were to win. I don't expect her to win. I expect her to lose, but the game will be, will it be a loss in single digits? Will it get under 10 points? If it gets under 10 points, 7, 8, 5, then she can go from there into South Carolina, where she has an advantage. The Nevada caucus, where she has a bit of an advantage, but Bernie Sanders will have some strength there in Nevada. But in South Carolina, where Ms. Clinton will have a better advantage, she'll go from there. And it'll just go on. She's in a race. Bernie Sanders is going to give her a race, and I know there are lots of Republicans and the Republican candidates who love that right now. So, speaking of the Republican candidates, did anyone hear what Barbara Bush said and how Donald Trump responded? Okay. On CBS this morning, the co-host Nora O'Donnell brought up an advertisement that's currently running in New Hampshire. The primary will be Tuesday, and it has been attacked by Donald Trump. I guess Barbara Bush is in the ad to advocate for her son, obviously. And Trump, as only Donald Trump can do, mocked it by saying that Jeb desperately needed mommy to help him. That's what Donald said. Okay. So then Barbara Bush, in hearing this, pointed to the fact that Vladimir Putin, the leader of Russia, has endorsed Trump. And she thought that that's this was in December, and Putin said Trump is a talented man who is an absolute leader of the presidential race. And she thought that that was horrible, that Donald Trump would take a endorsement from the leader of Russia. So Donald Trump attacked the mother of Jeb Bush by saying he needed his mommy to help him. He used the word mommy. Jeb. And Governor Bush has not been doing well. This New Hampshire primary that's coming up, he is about at 5 or 6%. He needs to pick it up because he is in bad shape. If he doesn't pick it up soon, let's see, I think the latest poll has Jeb Bush at 9%. Trump is in the lead with 29%. This was as a poll that ended yesterday. Marco Rubio has 12%. Ted Cruz has 12%. Jeb 9. Kasich, John Kasich, Governor Kasich 9. Carly Fiorina 8. Chris Christie 6. This has made a huge drop, and it serves him well. Chris Christie is a horrible candidate. He's too much bluster with Governor Christie in New Jersey. Just a lot of big talking how he's going to whoop Hillary Clinton's rear end, and he's going to and he said something about Marco Rubio this week. He's the boy in the bubble. Let's get the boy in the bubble up here and let's see what he's really about. The charge against Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, is that he's kind of lightweight. He is lightweight, but that's the charge that some of the Republican candidates are making. Marco Rubio, who finished third in the Iowa caucuses on Monday, he is looking for a second place finish because Donald Trump is in the lead. Whatever happened to Donald Trump in Iowa, at this point right now, it looks like he will win the New Hampshire primary come Tuesday. So he'll get that mojo back that he lost by coming into second place and almost being beaten by Marco Rubio for second. Rubio has a little bit of momentum. He needs to come in at least in second place. I think the strategists for Marco Rubio are saying basically he needs third place in Iowa. He needs second place in New Hampshire. And come South Carolina, he needs to win. That's the Marco Rubio long game based on his the people that are around him. Ted Cruz right now, who for me is just a little bit too evangelical, besides just being very, very hard right on a lot of issues. He's at 12%. New Hampshire seems like a, what is it, with the motto, New Hampshire? What's the motto? Live free or die. Live free or die is the state motto of New Hampshire. So they don't really go for the for lack of a better phrase, Bible thumping of Ted Cruz. So he's not looked at to be able to do much there. He may come in third place. The people that have to make a move, it's here are the people that have to do something this week. They have to show that they're going to make it or not. Chris Christie, John Kasich, and Jeb Bush needs to at least show up. He at least needs to show that he can get up into third or fourth place. He can't be down in fifth or sixth place, or there will be calls for Jeb Bush to get out of the race. Even though it is said that he is the number one person in South Carolina, but he may not be able to get there. So that is the game that is going on with him. Governor Bush, he just has no juice. He has no juice. Governor Kasich is probably the most competent person in the group, the governor of Ohio. But him being competent and steadfast and kind of a centrist in terms of Republican probably means he has no chance in this party. This party has turned Tea Party-ish. We need Donald Trump, somebody who's not been a politician before, to turn this thing upside down. Because if there's one thing that you hear from Trump supporters, they are tired of the politicians. It's not just about the Democrats. It's the Republicans, too. Those Republicans got down in Washington, and they just make money for themselves. They don't work for the people. Donald Trump supporters are very strongly behind him, and they believe that. And I think they're going to stick with him. After Monday or Tuesday, he was kind of knocked off his mojo a little bit, having lost Iowa. But I think he's back up on top with that mommy quote. Regarding Barbara Bush, I guess he is. He's back on top. If Donald Trump is tweeting, if he's on Twitter, he's feeling good. It's when he's not on Twitter that, you know, he's probably knocked off his mark a little bit. But he's back up on Twitter. If he's saying Jeb Bush desperately needed mommy to help him, he's okay. So Trump looks like the leader there right now. Carly Fiorina ran in California for the Senate against Barbara Boxer in 2010. I have never seen a woman or a man. Mitt Romney was pretty bad in 2012. Carly Fiorina told more Whoppers than Burger King has hamburgers. She told so many tall tales constantly in 2010, she couldn't be believed, and she has kept it up this go around. She's just a hard person to believe in. Evidently, there is a debate Saturday night with the Republicans. Carly Fiorina has not been invited, and she's making a kind of a stink about it. I think it's going to be Trump, Rubio, Cruz, Bush, Kasich, Christie, Dr. Carson. I think those are the people that are going to be in it. So that's seven people. Rand Paul is out of the race. Huckabee is out of the race. So for some reason, they're keeping Carly Fiorina out, even though she beat Christie and John Kasich Monday in Iowa. So we'll see how that goes. But what it looks like right now is that Donald Trump is going to be the winner. That's where it's going. Let me change, get out of that and switch around to some of my free flow stuff now, because obviously I want to talk about the Super Bowl. I don't know how many people watch the show Modern Family. Modern Family is a comedy that's on ABC. It's pretty funny. It's been on 5 or 6 years. It's won a lot of awards. It's a funny show. Sofia Vergara is on it. Ed O'Neill, who used to be on Married with Children, is the patriarch, kind of the grandfather, and he's got two kids. And they have families. Each one has a family. One of the families has a daughter, and her real name is Ariel Winter. She's been on the show since the beginning. She's now, I think she just turned 18. And the best way to describe Ariel is that she grew up quickly. Ariel, for lack of a better phrase, is voluptuous. And I don't know what this means, but she, before a few months ago, had a breast size of 34 double G. 34 double G. So she was noticed often. And when she went to award shows, she'd wear the, you know, the obligatory gowns and everything. And, you know, she looked older than her age. And obviously, you know, that makes it very tough on a young teenager to be catcalled and, you know, with social media to be described in certain ways that should not be done to a teenager. But she took the step a few months ago of having a breast reduction. And she decided to reduce, I believe she went from the 34 double G to 34 D as in David. And there was the SAG Awards this past weekend, and there are pictures of her in her gown. It's a very nice gown, beautiful gown, in fact, gorgeous gown, black gown, strapless, that you could see from the side the scar from the surgery. And so that obviously in the Twitter universe and Instagram and Facebook caused a lot of ruffle. And she made the statement that she was proud to be able to show that. She didn't want to be ashamed of it. And that, you know, other young ladies who have this issue should not be afraid of it also. What do you think about that? I think that as a guy, it's difficult because you definitely don't want women to be criticized for how they dress, or that, well, that happened to them because look at what she was wearing. No, that is a non-starter for me. That is absolutely. But as someone who works in the entertainment business, she does, her body is part of her work. She's a very attractive woman, young lady. I mean, like I said, she's just turned 18. So her part of her attractiveness is her body. And because she grew up so quickly, there was a lot of criticism about her. So, like I said, she went and made the change. As a guy, I'll never know. I'll never have 34 double G breast, and I'll never have to worry about what it's like to have a scar to get that changed. And I will say that she is very brave for doing what she did. And are there women out there like her who would have that situation? Absolutely. I can only say it's trouble because you are going to get a lot of criticism. She's going to get a lot of people catcalling and everything, and I just hope that she has a good family structure, people that will help support her, because you know she's gonna get the criticism. And but so far, I think she's done a pretty good job. And like I said, she took the lead to have that surgery and to not be afraid to show the scar. So kudos to her. Kudos to her. Absolutely, Ariel Winter. Check out the show. It's a funny show. Did anybody hear about the guy who was in a play in Italy and I guess part of the play was he had to put a noose around his neck and he ended up killing himself unintentionally. He didn't mean to, but it happened that he put it around too tight and he ended up killing himself in this Italian theater a few days ago. Someone in the audience saw that he had the noose around his neck very tightly, and he said someone help him, and he couldn't get it off, evidently. And this was on a, like, I think this was Tuesday night. And he was in very, very, very critical. He was in a coma for a few days. And he finally, they took him off life support this morning. Again, it was a play. And the part of the play was putting a noose around your neck, but evidently the noose was set up too tightly. So right now, the people who worked on the set or have been arrested. And we will see how that goes. But that is just a crazy story. Someone in the audience is the person that said, "Wait a minute, hey, that guy had that noose around his neck, he's strangling." And they finally stopped it. Otherwise, he could have actually absolutely died right on the spot. As it was, it took him a few days, and unfortunately, the man passed away. It's crazy, crazy story. Totally unfortunate. Why did the St. Louis Rams move from St. Louis to now being in Los Angeles, where, by the way, they used to be? I hope everyone knows that they used to be in Los Angeles, the football team. This is the football team. And the football team, the St. Louis Rams, who moved there in 1998, I want to say. No, I'm sorry, 1990, excuse me, 1995, 1995. The Los Angeles Rams moved to St. Louis. And they were there for, was it less, almost 20 years? Right at 20 years. Won a Super Bowl in St. Louis. I am from St. Louis. I know that a lot of people were very upset at the team leaving. They were a very good team in the early 2000s, but by the mid-2000s, they became one of the worst teams in the National Football League. And over the last 10 years, they just have not played well. Fan support dropped. And one of the things that happened was that this is the way I see it. When the Los Angeles Rams moved back in 94, 95, they were basically run out of Los Angeles. Georgia Frontieri owned the team. Her husband had owned the team, Mr. Rosenblum. He passed away. Georgia took over the team, the owner. She moved it out of the Los Angeles area, Los Angeles Coliseum, famous landmark in Los Angeles, and moved them down to Orange County to where the Los Angeles Angels play. So you moved them 30, 40 miles away. Attendance was bad, and it was literally no one in town wanted to support the team anymore because she made the team, it was just a bad team. The Los Angeles Rams of 92, 93, 94 were as bad as the St. Louis Rams of the last 5, 6 years. So the team left. And Miss Frontieri, being from originally St. Louis, found that there was a spot that she could move them to. So when the Cardinals, I'm always used to calling any baseball or football team in St. Louis Cardinals. When the Rams moved to town, there was a stadium, the Scott Trade Center. I hope I have all the facts right, and someone will always correct me if I'm wrong. But one of the parts of the lease was that that stadium, after a certain amount of time, had to be in the top half. So 32 teams in the NFL, it had to be in the top 10, top 15 best stadiums in the National League, in the National Football League. They had to make improvements in order to keep the team in the city, or otherwise it would be breaking the lease. Now, the city went along with that lease, that contract. They so wanted the team, but that contract came back to bite them because after Georgia Frontieri died and Stan Kroenke had a certain portion of the team, I think he owned like 30, 40%, and there was a possibility that the now owner of the Jacksonville team may have bought the team. His name is Khan. But he didn't buy it. Stan Kroenke bought him out, and this was also at the time where Rush Limbaugh was thinking about buying the Rams, and we know how that went over in St. Louis. Stan Kroenke bought the team, stock, lock, and barrel. And Stan Kroenke, being the real estate magnate that he is, held the city of St. Louis to the lease. He would not let them out of it. Improve the stadium, or we have rights to break the lease. And he made vocal intimations as though he wanted to stay there and he wanted to work it out, but he never did. He eventually bought property here in Los Angeles about 2 years ago, down by the Los Angeles Forum, where the Lakers used to play, and also not too far from the LAX, the airport, a huge piece of land. And he said that he wanted to build on that land. And that is pretty much what has happened over the course of the last 2 years, the back and forth with St. Louis, will they build a new stadium? There was a proposal for one that was right on the river, just north of downtown, north of Busch Stadium, the baseball stadium. It looked great, open air stadium, but the financing wasn't totally there. The NFL thought it was a good proposal, but they were short. I think they ended up $100 million short on the financing. And they eventually, as we now know, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, allowed the then St. Louis Rams to leave and move to Los Angeles. It left a lot of people angry. I couldn't talk to some of my friends for a week or two because they blamed it on me. I'm like, I have nothing to do with it. It's tough. My feeling is sports is an extravagance. And yes, it's a civic. It's a part of the city. It's a proud part. Listen, St. Louis fans love their baseball team. I do. My favorite team. And if that team ever thought about leaving, there would be some real. Now, you're talking about a team that has historical ties to St. Louis. The baseball Cardinals do. The football teams have had issues because at some level, between the Cardinals, the football Cardinals leaving in the late 80s, and now the Rams leaving in 2015, there has been some issue with either getting a new stadium or really a combination of getting a new stadium and overall fan support. But that fan support has to be tied into, when we're talking about the Bidwell back in the 80s, Daddy Bidwell, and now Kroenke, you're talking about people who weren't intent on making St. Louis their permanent hometown. They were looking for greener pastures as they see it. And with Bidwell, it turned out to be Phoenix, Arizona, and now with Kroenke back in Los Angeles. Teams come and go. This Los Angeles Ram team now, first was the Cleveland Rams, then it became the Los Angeles Rams, St. Louis Rams, and now it's Los Angeles Rams again. The Los Angeles Lakers used to be the Minneapolis Lakers. The Los Angeles Dodgers used to be the Brooklyn Dodgers. There's a lot of teams in this town that didn't start in this town, but that's what happens when you have, at one time, the St. Louis Cardinals were the farthest, most western team in the country in Major League Baseball up until 1958, when the Brooklyn Dodgers moved to Los Angeles. The St. Louis Cardinals were the farthest west team. So you got this whole western half of the country that really did not have a lot of sports before 1960, and now it's infiltrated. As long as you're beholden to owners who have the right to either commit to staying in a town or deciding that they want to pull up stakes and go somewhere where they can make more money, and whatever you think about Kroenke, he believes he can make more money in Los Angeles. He is building what he feels is going to be a even better version of Ballpark Village that's in St. Louis at the new Busch Stadium. He's going to build something similar and probably bigger and better out here. Now, will it work long term? LA has lost a football team before, so they can certainly lose one again. And based on what I've heard today from the NFL commissioner, they are committed to having the San Diego team, which was looking to be a tenant with the Rams in their new stadium, that won't start until 2018, 2019. they're not moving into the new stadium. They're going to use the Coliseum for now. But the commissioner right now is intent on the San Diego team staying in San Diego and the Oakland team staying in Oakland. Now, that's not what was talked about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I don't know if that's a little positioning or, you know, 2 years ago, Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, was saying, you know, we're intent on staying in St. Louis. So words are subject to change. San Diego has a contractual opening to join the Los Angeles Rams in the new stadium. It's open to them. They have until next year to decide if they want to pull up stakes in San Diego and come and share the new stadium with the Rams. And obviously one of the big deals for the ownership of the Chargers is, are they going to be a tenant or are they going to be an owner? And I think Kroenke wants a tenant. He does not want to give up ownership of the building to the Spanoses. The Spanos family is the family that owns the Chargers. So we'll see how that goes. And if the Chargers don't decide to stay in San Diego, Oakland has a chance, an opportunity to move to Los Angeles. They have been here before. I don't think they want to come here again. We've been hearing talk about Vegas. Las Vegas may take the Raiders. So that whole thing is up in the air. But it seems like in football, football has been the sport that's had the musical chairs. And it being the biggest sport in the country, it's the one where people have the most angst if they're losing a team or the most happiness if someone is getting a team. So, you know, you had new expansion teams in the last 10, 15 years in Houston, Jacksonville. The team that's playing in the Super Bowl tomorrow, Carolina, was an expansion team in 1996. So they're only 20 years old, Carolina Panthers, the franchise. So we will see. I feel for my people in St. Louis because I know they hated losing the team. Stan Kroenke is a curse word or curse phrase there now. They never want to see him again. And he's from Missouri. It's just amazing that he would do things so shabbily to create such bad will, but that's what the man did. Now people are going to try to embrace him here, and we will see what happens. Speaking of football, that game on Sunday, the Super Bowl, Carolina Panthers versus Denver Broncos. And there's been all the talk all week, and I've tried to keep up with some of it. It's just, as someone who loves football, I can OD on too much football. I have to get away from it. But there's been a lot of discussion about and I'll give my prediction at the end. I'll give my prediction in a few minutes. There's been a lot of discussion about what Cam Newton said last week about being an African-American quarterback. And why did he have to say that? And we know he's African-American. I liked it. And by the way, it's too many words for me. And I grew up with being black, so I like black as opposed to African-American. I know people, I use it sometimes interchangeably, but I'm black. Even though I'm basically brown, but I'm black. That's just the way I am. So, but he made the statement, I'm a black quarterback. And it's caused a lot of kerfuffle. You know, I'm a black quarterback. You haven't seen anyone like me. Now, what did he mean by that? I'm going to try to explain it as best as I can, and I'm going to let this go. Hopefully, he won't say anything after the game Sunday that'll start stuff up again. Because he really, I understand why he did it, but at this point now, he doesn't need to do it. We know who he is. We know the position he's in. He didn't have to describe himself. He needs to let other people do that outside of him. We know who he is. But let me try to give an idea for those of you out there in the audience of why he spoke up and said, I'm an African-American quarterback. You haven't seen anyone like me. 30, 40 years ago, and I would say now in the NFL, there has probably been about, all told, whether starters or backups, about 40 African-American quarterbacks, black quarterbacks over the years, since 1960, essentially. There was a few in the late 60s, early 70s, James Harris for the Rams, Joe Gilliam for the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 70s, you know, a few there. And then going into the 80s, you had Randall Cunningham, Then into the 90s, you had people like Donovan McNabb. And we have Steve McNair, the Mike Vicks of the world. And when I mention those last three, and we know, if you know anything about football, you know Mike Vick had his issue outside of football with the whole dog biting incident. But Donovan McNabb, Steve McNair, very good quarterback in the late 90s, early 2000s, Mike Vick, when they were asked, whenever they had been asked about being a black quarterback, they didn't want to touch it. No, I'm just a quarterback. Don't put black on me. I'm just a quarterback. I'm just out here to do my job. They did not want to get involved with it. And if you go back 10, 15 years before that, you know, Warren Moon, who had turned, came, became a Hall of Fame quarterback, came out of college, won the Rose Bowl, couldn't find a job in the NFL, had to go to the Canadian Football League up north, won bowl Grey Cups up there, their equivalent of the Super Bowl, came back to the NFL after 6 years, and he's still in the top 10 in touchdown passes and yardage thrown after 6 years in the Canadian League. Just what he did in the NFL, he's in the top 10 all time. So he proved his worth. But he didn't want to be known as a black quarterback. They want to be known as a quarterback who can play as well as the Brett Favres and the Joe Namaths and the Lenny Dawsons and Terry Bradshaws. They just wanted to be who they were. So what Cam was getting at, and this is what he was speaking to the black community, basically. I'm going to go a little Chris Rock here. He was not talking to every black person, so to speak. He wasn't talking to – there's a difference between a black person and a brother, okay? And the brothers are the ones that are hanging out, that are in the barbershops, that talk sports, that are unapologetically black, that will let you know they are. They're happy with who they are. They wear it on their sleeve, on their chest. They're proud of who they are. And what Cam was doing was basically saying, I am unapologetically who I am. I'm going to embrace this, and folks from my community can understand it. They can relate to it. More importantly, they appreciate it, because usually people who were my predecessors, like I said, the Steve McNairs, the Mike Vick, those who came before me, not all quarterbacks, but some, they weren't too keen in letting people know that they were black. They wanted to just be a quarterback. And because they weren't too keen in doing so, we had an establishment, the press, the mainstream media, the sports establishment out there that found them, the Vicks and the McNairs, to be easier to embrace, because they didn't express their blackness. They just wanted to be a quarterback. So they found them easier to embrace than they would be to embrace me. I don't like it, but I won't let it interrupt who I am. That's, for me and for others, is what Cam was trying to say. Some people get it, some don't. But there are a lot of people in the black community who understand what he was doing. He was taking a stand, because for so long, there were a lot of quarterbacks who happened to be black who just didn't want to touch it. And because they didn't want to touch it, they were embraced by the mainstream media. Now we criticize the mainstream media when we talk about politics. Well, this is the mainstream media in sports. And because Donovan McNabb shied away from it, no, just treat me like I am, I'm just a person, they were embraced. Cam, almost at the pinnacle of his career, and he's only 25, 26 years old. He's got a long way to go, and he's got to continue doing what he's doing. He has felt empowered. And let's also remember another thing, why he said what he said. He's already been paid. He signed a 5-year, $103 million contract back in the offseason. So he could say what he said last week without worrying about if it would affect him come contract time. Now, he signed his contract. He has played the way he's played this year. He'll probably be the MVP of the NFL. It's either he or Tom Brady. And that's my interpretation of what he said. He said that for the people in his community who understand it, who appreciate him, because he was proud enough to say that. Because he knows that there was a time when quarterbacks, if they said that, they would not have been embraced by the mainstream media. They would have been ostracized. Well, Cam is saying, you can't ostracize me. I'm dabbing. I'm dancing. And besides, when I score a touchdown, I'm giving the ball to the kids. What are you going to do about it? Dab on them, Cam. That's what that's about, in my opinion. So, in terms of the game, and let me say, I love Peyton Manning. Peyton has been a great quarterback. If Peyton runs for office in the next few years, whatever if he continues selling Papa John's pizza, I got a problem with Papa John's because of a little bit of the Obamacare, ACA. I got a little bit of problem with Papa John's. But if Peyton ran for office, I'd give Peyton a look. He's been a great quarterback. He's been and that family. His father was a professional quarterback. Peyton, obviously. His brother Eli has won 2 Super Bowls. Peyton has only won 1. Peyton will go down as one of the top 3 or 4 quarterbacks in the history of the game. I think on Sunday he's going to meet his match because as a team, his defense is unbelievable. The Denver Broncos have a great defense. But Cam Newton and the offense that they're running, they're just on another level this year. And I don't believe that they can stop Cam from running and passing. It is going to be very difficult to for the whole game. Now, it may be a close game. I hope it's a close game for the first half, you know, maybe early third quarter. And the thing is Carolina has been running out on teams the last 2 games in the playoffs. They had a 31-0 lead against Seattle, and they had a 17-0 lead to start against Arizona, and they ended up scoring 49 points. I think it was 49-20 or 49-15, something. They just blew out Seattle and Arizona, 2 very good teams, extremely good teams. You could make an argument that Seattle or Arizona could be the favorite against Denver in this game this week. So Carolina has beaten the best. Denver and the AFC has also beaten the best. This season, the NFC has been a stronger conference than the AFC. So Denver beat New England and Tom Brady, but I think they're going to meet their match here. I think that Cam Newton will end up being the MVP of the game. I think the final score will be 30-17. I think they will score 3 touchdowns, 3 field goals, and basically throttle the Denver Broncos. I just think that they are too strong of a team. Now, one key that could be a variable in this game, one of the linebackers for the Carolina Panthers, his name is Thomas Davis, broke his arm 2 weeks ago in the game. A guy was running and he jumped in the air, and then jumping in the air, his leg hit Thomas Davis in the arm. He broke a bone in his arm. He has a cast on that arm, but he is going to play on Sunday. If he's not able to, the best linebacker in the game, Luke Kuechly, is his running mate, 2 linebackers, but he'll be on his own. Would make a difference in the game if he's not able to play, but otherwise he will be there. So I think Carolina will win. I will be back on Monday at 12 noon. I'm going to talk about baseball. I'm going to talk about baseball team. I'm going to find out what's going on in the politics on that day. Have a great weekend, everyone, and I'm going to go out with some more Earth, Wind, and Fire.